Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on gossip and all that. Our speaker making his first appearance at the Sydney Institute, out in the wings for a walk-on start, is Joe Aston, who of course is the Rear Window columnist at the Financial Review. But Joe studied journalism at the UTS in Sydney. He worked for Joe Hockey, he's worked for Bruce Beard and for Qantas and Etihad, came back to Australia, and from 2011 has been doing the Rear Window column at the Financial Review, which I'm sure many of you read. And so tonight we welcome Joe Aston, speaking on the topic in defence of silliness, purience and sedition, being a gossip columnist. Welcome, Mr. Aston.
Good evening. I just want to acknowledge two people here before I start. One is the Premier, Barry O'Farrell. The thing I love about Barry is that he's cultured and well-read without being Bob Carr. the other person I'd like to acknowledge is my mother, Julia, who's the only other person I'd entrust with the state's finances. I'm excited and nervous to be addressing the Sydney Institute tonight. I'm excited because I greatly admire Gerard and Anne Henderson and what they've done over more than two decades for public ideas and discourse in this country. I'm nervous because I suspect that guy at the back of the room isn't filming this for posterity. Just the one decade ago, I was straight off the plane from Hobart and I turned up in this very room for a talk by the late journalist Matt Price. And if I remember correctly, he turned up with his golf clubs. Matt surely was the best sketch writer of his generation. I was never fortunate enough to know him personally, but as an HSC student loafing around the school library and laughing out loud at his column in The Australian, I certainly felt like I did. Later, it was for the Institute's annual dinner in 2008 that I purchased my first tuxedo, a formative moment in any boy's transition to man-child. I thought I'd cut quite the figure in my Xenia ensemble. Yet during proceedings, as I strode innocently towards the restroom, one guest cruelly mistook me for a waiter, clicking her fingers and hollering at me for a glass of red, which was a low point. It's not only Catholicism that I share with Gerard and Anne. I'm not sure how widely it's known, but like myself, Gerard cut his teeth in Tasmanian politics. His first gig as a staffer was in the Launceston office of the Liberal member for Bass, Kevin Newman. So you could say that Gerard and I learned to count heads the same way. And I know that Anne too has a special place in her heart for the Apple Isle, having authored the seminal biography of a Catholic Tasmanian Prime Minister named Joseph. Can I just say I'm not ruling anything in or out? To those of you who are not lawyers engaged by Fairfax, thank you for coming. And what a ragtag crowd this is. I see paternalists, colonialists, jingoists and drunks, capitalists, or should I say disciples of the vertically integrated military-industrial complex, Anglo-centrics, fellow-centrics, meat-eaters and right-handers. And the housewives up the back, presumably logging. All in all, I like what I see. It's my kind of crowd. So let's get down to it. People really hate me until they get to know me, so I'm the reverse of Kevin Rudd. I'm going to start with George Orwell. All writers, he said, are vain, selfish, and lazy. and at the very bottom of their motives there lies a mystery. Vain, selfish and lazy is how I came to be a gossip columnist. The mystery is why I like it so much. But here's how I'm going to explain my motives. Firstly, how I really came to be a gossip columnist, then how I see gossip columnising today, and that I'll do in two parts, gossip's canvas being public life and gossip's brush being the tools of the trade, silliness, prurience and sedition. Orwell knew he was destined to be a writer by the age of six. He said, "I knew that I had a facility with words and a power of facing unpleasant facts, and I felt that this created a sort of private world in which I could get my own back for my failure in everyday life. When I was six, I wanted to be Hulk Hogan. But eventually, I came around to George's worldview, one where my facilities, and wrestling was not one of them, would compensate for my failures. Sadly, there was nothing mythical or heroic about my childhood. I wasn't a baby in the bulrushes. I didn't grow up in a brown paper bag or the back of a car. I didn't float to Australia on a stick of spaghetti. I didn't overcome enormous obstacles only to come good in the end, which should really disqualify me from giving speeches like this one. When I was seven, we left New South Wales so Dad could work in the Tasmanian health system. Initially, we lived on the sweeping grounds of the infamous Royal Derwent Asylum in New Norfolk, 35 kilometres from Hobart. So I can talk about a sheltered upbringing with some authority. And if cause or effect is attributable in my case, this was probably where I developed such a warped appetite for the morbid and for the absurd. Then I became an altar boy. My memories of church are happy ones. My memories of church are happy ones because they remind me of a time when I still preferred bread over wine. At some indeterminate point, probably in high school, another strange thing happened. I woke up one day furnished with a curious certainty that I was vastly smarter than my parents, my teachers, and indeed the world's leaders. That was neither a happy nor a true realisation. Nevertheless, and rightly or wrongly, this was probably when sedition entered my repertoire. In the student newspaper, I railed against the headmaster, calling him a spineless jellyfish, which at that age I thought was quite droll rather than an embarrassing tautology. Being a self-appointed genius, I also failed to grasp why I wasn't more popular with my peers. What a surprise that I'm still grappling with that problem. Then came university and the big city. My first journalism class at UTS was comprised 11 wannabe TV stars whose aspiration was to host Getaway, whom hilariously are now my neighbours at Channel 9, and three or four emos eagerly writing urban affairs stories about the lesbian Malou in Erskineville. They all went on to join the federal bureaucracy. I went to Whitlam's concerts, but I still couldn't get that angry about John Howard. I liked his pocket handkerchiefs. And contrarianism is surely the only way to explain why I went to work for Joe Hockey, then the Minister for Work Choices. It was like selling cancer. Here was that seditious inclination again. We were 2 months from electoral doom when the PM refused to step down for Peter Costello, even though Cabinet had effectively asked him to. The very next day, Queensland Premier Peter Beattie retired. The announcement came through to Hockey's ministerial staff on email. Fatefully, I clicked on reply all and wrote, "Funny how Labor leaders know how to go out on top." When the Prime Minister's senior adviser, Jamie Briggs, got his hands on this correspondence, what came to pass closely resembled all the worst parts of the Book of Revelation. After that election, I went to work for Qantas. And what I quickly learned, and I'm talking here about the entire private sector, is that big business is even more rife with cant and farce than politics. and that generally speaking, there is no correlation between executive capacity and remuneration. Indeed, the two may be inversely proportionate. In 2010, I switched airlines to Etihad and did a year and a bit stint in the Gulf state of Abu Dhabi. You really couldn't make that place up. A comical Atlantis. Vegas without the fun. Unlike our Lord, who usefully transubstantiated water into wine, the Emiratis transform oil into water via desalination plants and use it to grow shrubs along lush median strips on innumerable freeways to nowhere. I'm certain that in 500 years, explorers will stumble upon its ruins in the sand and be completely unable to comprehend what it was and why it was there. Which brings me to now in Rear Window. When in December 2011, my long-suffering friend and boss James Chessel floated my name for the job, our editor-in-chief, Michael Stutchbury, replied simply, "Good idea, at least when he flames out, it'll be entertaining." I haven't flamed out yet, but I've come pretty close. With Orwell's intent, but sadly not his faculty, getting my own back for my failure in everyday life. So, what kind of fresh hell, to borrow a Dorothy Parkerism, does a gossip columnist have to work with today in Australia? If you're looking at a mass conflagration of voices that comprises some kind of public discourse, there are two things that stick out in my mind. A lack of plain speaking and a lack of clear thinking. Right across public life. Political porkies, corporate jargon, grammatical fascism, art wowserism, opponent labelling, all of which are debasing ideas and debate. There used to be a kind of bar that our leaders used to have to get over. Now they just limbo dance under it. I was in Canberra last week for Wayne Swan's final budget. It's been a roundabout journey to the Treasurer's sixth consecutive deficit. The government unequivocally promised more than 200 times and for 3 years, right up until 5 months ago, that there would be a surplus. Swan fell almost $18 billion short. He didn't even blush. And the nation didn't even blink. Why would there be any meaningful correlation between his utterances and his actions? We've been conditioned to expect no different. Not just of politicians. CEOs have taken their lead. Where ministers have staffers, bosses have management consultants. And the sign today of a successful corporate speech is the complete absence of a single word not in the approved and meaningless lexicon. Now, there are obvious consequences for public discourse when language is debased and words lose their meaning. People stop listening. Original thinking can't cut through. And if you don't have the language for new ideas, you can't formulate them, let alone satirise them. At Gerard and Anne's annual dinner last month, I was chatting with one guest after Amanda Foreman's speech. And this captain of industry was most exercised by the fact that Dr. Foreman had used only masculine pronouns, he instead of she. I had missed the big takeout from the speech. It wasn't about leadership. It was about women, ironically, emasculating themselves and each other through grammatical solecism. It was 40 years ago, around the time Neil Young was singing A Man Needs a Maid, that political correctness first began to affect public thinking. As an unfortunate byproduct of otherwise laudable movements, civil and gay rights, and the feminist and multicultural projects. PC has peaked and troughed along the way, but here and now it is flourishing. Exhibit A, Bernie Brooks, the CEO of Myer. He was howled down earlier this month for daring to suggest that raising the Medicare levy could undermine discretionary consumer spending. Bernie broaching the economic effects of a tax increase was not a statement of fact from a CEO whose obligation is to maximise the value of his business for its shareholders. The mob decided it was a callous repudiation of those whom that revenue is intended for, in this case, the disabled. Again, I had completely missed the point. But 20 years ago now, Washington Post columnist E.J. Dion Jr. wrote of how the moralism of the left had blinded it to the legitimate source of middle-class anger, and that the revolt against a growing tax burden was not an expression of selfishness, but simply a reaction to the difficulties of maintaining a middle-class standard of living. Now, clearly the Twittersphere has mobilised the outraged class. The movement is typified by a nauseating moral smugness and almost Eastern European levels of humourlessness. What they share is a lust to take offence, often where none should exist, and its objective is the total immolation of the white middle-class male. I hesitate to frame this as a left versus right battle. Certainly, the elite, or what I call the rich left, are PC junkies. One media commentator thundered that I was a dick for referring to her as a mummy blogger. Another accused me of being a woman hater. Sexism is one of the PC brigade's favourite cheap shots. But criticising the validity of a woman's argument or poking fun at her foibles does not chauvinism make. By this absurd reasoning, I am an anti-Semite for making fun of David Gonski or a racist for laughing at Noel Pearson. This is now a regular tactic used in public debate. When you disagree with someone, you divert from the substance of their argument and stake out the moral high ground by slapping a dirty label on them. As Peter Fitzsimons put it so aptly in the Sydney Morning Herald last month, it's a straw man argument. It works, and I'm still quoting Fitzy, by attacking a position your opponent never held. But as I said, this is not a purely ideological battle. Not even mostly. To cite the late Robert Hughes, left and right are now locked in a full-blown, mutually sustaining folie à deux, and the only person each dislikes more than the other is the one who tells both to lighten up. Hughes was a legend, and not simply because he was a white European male. Upon his death last year, his nephew by marriage, Malcolm Turnbull, gave a rousing speech in the House of Representatives, in which he briefly made reference to the deceased. I kid. Presumably Hughes heartily approved of Malcolm rallying against the PC charge, which broke out on his right flank over the Bill Henson furor. When it came to Henson's art, we had Kevin Rudd decrying it and Malcolm buying it. Nobody has better satirised art wankers and wowsers than Tom Wolfe in The Painted Word. And I'll quote him. If the moralists are yelling for the blood of any poet or performer whose work doesn't accord with family values and might raise hackles in some golf club in Tulsa, just turn towards stuff that nobody could quarrel with. Among needlework, coastal seagrass basketry, Southeast Alaskan native dance, American Indian basketry and woodcraft, Pacific Island canoe building and Appalachian banjo playing. There are many more infuriating examples, but I must move on to the tools of the trade. The New York Daily Mirror's Walter Winchell was arguably the original gossip columnist. Gossip writing, wrote his biographer St. Clair McKelway, is at present like a spirochet in the body of journalism. Really, it's a modest inconvenience in my line of work to be likened to syphilis. But McKelway said this 70 years ago, during the Second World War. I shudder to imagine what gruesome ailment he'd use to describe the craft today. Some think that what we do is a blot on society. Nothing but vile schadenfreude. Not true. Our brand of journalism does serve a purpose and a public good. Quite simply, to identify and illuminate all forms of public humbug, hubris, cant, sophistry, hypocrisy, absurdity, orthodoxy and sanctimony. A mongrel breed somewhere between sketch, comment, news, satire and polemic. necessary to present a comprehensive and fearlessly accurate telling of the news, and to entertain. Sammy Davis Jr. sang that tune, "What Kind of Fool Am I?" Well, my job is to tell them. As far as I'm concerned, I have but three masters: those who pay me, those who read me, and my conscience. Obviously, I'm not married. As I flagged in the topic of tonight's talk, the three pillars of gossip columnising, as I see it, are an unhealthy regard for the absurd, a curiosity for all matters of sex, and a preparedness to take no account of authority. I'll start with silliness. Paul Keating once said to me, "I don't think much of silly columns in serious newspapers. The test should be, would it belong in the FT?" He sounded like the Earl of Chesterfield, who in the 18th century reckoned there is nothing so illiberal and so ill-bred as audible laughter. Now, PJK is my hero. His portrait even hangs above my piano at home. But come on. I mean, this is a guy who called the Senate unrepresentative swill and the opposition leader a perfumed gigolo. He'd be at home at the lodge listening to Marla in his pyjamas at 10 a.m. instead of down at Parliament roasting some bureaucrat. And we loved him for it because he was plain speaking and he was wicked. Other than Mark Latham, which Australian politician would have made a better gossip columnist? I rest my case. Well, almost. There are a lot of public figures in Australia who take themselves far too seriously. Captains of industry get hopping mad about the nicknames I use for them. Apparently, they're too important to be ridiculed. Does that not prove exactly why I'm doing it? One subject of caricature even called me to complain that I was being inaccurate. I wrote that she lived in Mossman when she lives in Cremorne Point. I said she drives a Range Rover when she drives some other gas-guzzling European vehicle. I said she's friends with Ann Summers when she's actually friends with Mike Carlton. Again, I said, it's called caricature. Will we also demand that cartoonists like Bill Leake and David Rowe draw Abbott's ears and Gillard's nose to their exact proportions for the sake of accuracy? The best kind of silliness is directed at oneself. The former title deeds gossip Jonathan Chancellor told me last year, "You're such a brilliant columnist, you remind me of myself." And that told me everything I needed to worry about. The moral here is simply that we all need to take a regular chill pill. That for the most part, our careers and our reputations are not matters of war and peace. To quote Prospero from The Tempest, "Our revels now are ended, are melted into air, into thin air, and like insubstantial pageant faded, leave not a rack behind." Now to prurience. It was apocryphally Oscar Wilde's view that everything in the world is about sex, except sex. Sex is about power. Now, this is a lectern, not a confessional. Shari Markson may have taken orgasms off the cover of Cleo, but I suspect women are as interested in them as they ever were. Next, they'll be banning fast cars from Top Gear. It's simply fact that people are hardwired to enjoy sex and to talk, think, and read about sex. Sex in the media isn't just important for its literal implication as a window into the bedroom. Its coverage is a metaphor for human relationships, frailties, and raw emotions. Whether it's Olivia Wirth and Paul Howes, or Greg Combey and Juanita Phillips, or Richard Pratt's mistresses, or Craig Thompson's alleged prostitutes, or Tim Matheson's small female Asian doctor. Allusions to the bedroom fascinate people. I'll just tell a quick story off the cuff. The great Peter Meakin, the former current affairs director, news and current affairs director at Channel 7, was in a huff when they pulled Juanita Phillips off the ABC News, saying, geez, if we pulled reporters off the job every time they were bonking a public figure, there'd be nobody left to read the news. I thought, that's more like it. But these stories, prurient stories, often have genuine news value. And then finally, sedition. Shakespeare wrote about art tongue-tied by authority. And Salone's essay in The God That Failed defined liberty as the possibility of doubting, the possibility of making a mistake, the possibility of searching and experimenting, the possibility of saying no to any authority, literary, artistic, philosophic, religious, social, and even political. The core of good journalism is curiosity and scepticism. And the bedrock of gossip, is absolute, unadulterated, terrifying fearlessness. That's what people want to read, except about themselves. In the past 5 days, I've been character referenced 4 times in The Australian, and once even in the Daily Telegraph Sydney Confidential. That's when you know you've really made it. That tells me 2 things. One, about the sorry state of the Australian media. And 2, that my column must be working. I'd rather make away for 10 minutes than toil away safely for a lifetime. Sure, there are days when I overclub, even by my standards. But the day I shrink away from writing something that is true and that is in the public interest is the day I hope Stutch, my editor, taps me on the shoulder and promotes me to the landscape gardening round. So in conclusion, whichever way you look at it, ours is a tough beat. I've told you tonight only what I aim to achieve each morning when I crawl forlornly out of bed, not what will actually happen after 6 bottles of Piero, 2 double gins with 1 ice cube, and a schooner of limoncello with Richard Wilkins at Machiavelli. Look back through this essay, Orwell also said, and for certain you will find that I have again and again committed the very faults that I am protesting against. I'm as imperfect as the public figures I lampoon, and I fully expect my ruination is only around the corner. I think of Truman Capote, whose unflinching account of his own friends in New York high society, La Côte Basque, spelled his social suicide. But in this game, you have to know who your real friends are, and you cannot care what the rest think of you. As the late San Francisco Chronicle columnist Herb Cain said, columnists who make friends lose readers. Maybe thus, it's inevitable that I'll have the same turnout at my funeral as Winchell did. 2 people, if you include the priest. So be it. Thank you.
Thanks, Joe, for an entertaining talk. It was actually Anne's idea to invite Joe along, and I said, well, that's fine, but is our defamation insurance up to date? It is. So we come to question discussion. First, I should thank King & Wood Mellisons for the use of this facility tonight. I was interested in your comment about you and the Australian, because you're going at the Oz and the Oz is going at you, so I just... It's quite entertaining to read this. But going back to one of your other critics, I think Mia Farrow, she spoke here. And,
Mia Freeman, I think.
You picked it. That was the John Law-style deliberate mistake that I occasionally throw in just to see the gossip column. I think she did call you a dick, but I think she... also complained that you'd called her a penis blogger, and the question really was, from the deep thinking set that had a drink after the talk, was what is a penis blogger, and do you need to have a penis to be a penis blogger, or what is that all about? Because this is an unresolved question from 2 months ago. How does a Sheila like that become a penis blogger like her? That's the question.
A penis blogger is somebody who blogs about penises. And at the time that I coined that phrase, Peter Slipper was under fire for his fairly vile text messages, although they were private when he sent them, about female genitalia. And I just thought, given most of the commentary was about that in from a serious angle, I thought it was interesting to see a leading voice of feminism, in a qualified sense, who blogs about things like clouds that look like penises or nine things that look like vaginas. And it was obviously an attempt to make light of a lot of what I think is insubstantial white noise out there in the commentariat, and I don't roll away from thinking that Mamma Mia is full of a lot of that. But look, Mia is a very successful entrepreneur, and we have had our political differences, and geez, that's no shock there. One I remembered was when was it Doris or Bette Davis that died first? I can't remember. I think Bette died first, and I'm sure it was Joan Davis who died first. Anyway, whatever. Whoever it was, Joan Crawford. Am I getting closer?
Could have been Mia Farrow.
Joan Crawford. Sorry, I've got it. And Variety, of course, called around and said to Bette, "Have you got a comment about her?" And she said, "Yeah. The rule is, you only say good things about the dead. So here's my quote: Joan Crawford is dead. Good." And so when Mia comes up with something that good, I hope she uses it.
One down there.
Straight down there, yeah.
Hi, Joe. Ian Higgins from the Australian. Honoured to be here, of course. I'm just wondering, gossip writing is a very specialised type of genre. It's hard and it's not easy to do. But do you feel that you still have to apply the usual set of journalistic ethics to your work? That's to say, checking facts, making sure that what you write is correct, and then correcting things if you make a mistake.
I feel like I'm being about to be railroaded on a particular example here. But in all fairness, absolutely. Absolutely. And I only called your editor-in-chief last week to apologise for getting something wrong.
Well, that's my next question.
Hang on, we're not having a... It'll be very brief. Okay, then we move on.
Okay, so the one question is, why did you not then, you admitted the mistake to Chris on your telephone call, why didn't you use the normal journalistic practice of correcting it in the paper?
Oh, look, I didn't think it was substantial enough to warrant a whole new article. And in fact, I wouldn't worry too much because I think you'll find he corrected it in his paper.
I hope everyone's not intimidated.
You referred to your twin objectives of truth and public interest. If we had no defamation laws, would your column read any differently?
I suspect so. I have a really great, I should say Fairfax and the Fin Review Group in particular, have a great lawyer, Richard Coleman, and I take up a fair bit of his time. I don't think... Look, defamation laws are very strict in Australia, but this is a legal question, and I know it's media law, but I wouldn't want to overreach and pretend that I'm an expert. I certainly know how it works now. I'm very familiar with that. I don't know what I think about how it should work. I just pretty much apply. I'll keep my thoughts within the framework I've got to work with. And look, sometimes I think it's unfortunate because there are stories that I haven't been able to write that I think have a public interest. But there are other times where I think it saved me from myself.
Before I go there, just going back on the other question, if you do make a mistake, it's pretty easy to put in your column, isn't it? You know, I got it wrong.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and that happens. All the time. But look, it's a case of, if you, it's that tipping point, isn't it? If you make a mistake, do you draw more attention to the whole thing by writing about it again, or do you just let it go by the wayside? And
there's a question there.
Joey, thanks for your speech. Where, obviously, defamation is a line that you can't cross over, but where do you draw
not,
the line?
Not always true.
Not always true, okay.
Not supposed to cross over.
Well, maybe you can give an example where you would cross over and why. But from a personal point of view, what boundaries do you set yourself?
Oh, God, that's very... very difficult question to answer. Look, prurience is one that I've just talked about, and in that particular kind of sphere of or genre, you have to be particularly careful because people's personal lives are their personal lives, and people, quite rightly, take it hard when they're made public. So there really does have to be a public interest to write about somebody's relationship or affair or whatever it might be. Now, you know, if it's the alleged misappropriation of union funds, well, there's certainly a public interest there. You know, if in the case of, you know, Paul Howes and Olivia Wirth, clearly, you know, the corporate implications of an executive at an airline and a union leader involved with complex industrial issues, of course there's an issue there. But, for example, Juanita Phillips and Greg Combe is one that I just find completely perplexing. I mean, Juanita reads the news. She doesn't run around making kind of pejorative comments and subjective comments. I mean, so that's one I just think, well, what is the validity of removing her as a newsreader from the ABC? So I don't really know. You know, people have a right to sleep with whoever they want or do whatever they want with their private lives if it's legal. And to a certain extent, even if it's not. And at what point do you go, you know, this impacts their job? I mean, that's a very nebulous line, and I struggle with that all the time. So, and probably get it wrong sometimes, maybe lots of times. I don't know. But you know, it's a very, very hard one to pick. Sorry if that's not much of an answer.
There's a question through there.
Hi, Joe. Hilarious. Have you ever lost a story because your editor thought it was too serious and he moved to another part of the paper?
That's a good question. When I first started, that did happen to me a fair bit. You got a really cracking yarn that was newsy and was first. The first, and I think it's because of necessarily where the column was at when I arrived, people would say, whether it was my editor or deputy editor or whatever, would say, oh no, that's a news story, that belongs in the front of the book. And over time, I've kind of... But then, of course, on the other side of the face, they'd look at the column and say, this is all comment, what are you talking... there's no news in here. So they started off with this completely odd push and pull. And I'm now at the point where it's pretty hard to take a news story off me, and it'll go in my column. And I said, but that's a news story. I said, okay, then puff it off the front, but it's going in my column because it's my story. And so you just have to put your foot down. And the other thing is, a lot of stuff doesn't end up in the column because you know it won't hold. So if Barry's about to tell his cabinet that his chief of staff is leaving in 2 hours, You don't tell 21 politicians something and expect it to stay a secret. It's got to go straight away. And that goes up on the website. It goes out on social media, and that's how it's circulated. So in those cases, you lose them, but that's more a factor of today's kind of news cycle and technologies than anything.
Last night, people were asking Ruby Wax if she was suffering from deep depression. And I just wondered, do you think it's a myth that people who make other people laugh are secretly or actually are people depressed?
How depressed are you?
This woman's a cracker. I can't speak for others, but look, yeah, you do suspect that about others, about certain comedians. look, I think the urge to make people laugh is probably from a very deep, dark place. Yes, but I left that back in Royal Derwent Asylum, so I'm just going to leave it. I'm not going there any further with that one.
Question on the back here. Yeah.
Joe, as someone who consumes media a lot on the corporate side of things, we've noticed since you've been writing in the Financial Review that executives are actually now reaching for the Financial Review first in the mornings again, so congratulations. But social media, how is that going to keep challenging you? I mean, you broke the story about Peter McConnell this week, but it was behind a paywall.
McConnell, by the way.
McConnell.
Yes, it was.
That guy. But it was behind a paywall. And, you know, social media has gone beyond paywalls and all that sort of thing like that. Is Fairfax holding you back from being a really effective gossip columnist?
Well, we're going to a metered model at the Fin Review, so this time sometime this year. And obviously, so is the Herald and the Age about to do the same. And Kim Williams announced the same for the Herald Sun and the Telegraph and the Courier Mail and so on and so forth. So that's certainly where the media is going. So everyone will soon, I think, be pretty much working with the same arrangements on that front. And I think even the Australian does the same. That is certainly annoying at times when you put stuff out and you know people can't actually read your story. But you would hope that critical mass, if there are enough of them and the tease is good enough, that they'll subscribe. And, you know, in the state, the way the media is heading, you know, getting people to pay for content is absolutely the only way we are going to be able to continue doing what we do. Doesn't matter which media company you're from. So I'm, if anything, if thinking in the medium to long term, I'm very happy to be working for a company that, certainly the Fin has had a paywall for a very long time, and I think that's helped us deal with the fact that to be a bit ahead of the ball on that front. I mean, obviously the paywall strategy has changed, it's a lot cheaper, but I think the metered model will be great. And you know, then people will be able to read 10, 12 stories a month or whatever it is. And so in terms of getting casual readers and eyeballs, that'll be a really empowering thing. But still, I hope they pay.
Chris.
Joe, there was a stage some time ago when a number of politicians, particularly federally, were actually known as witty, capable of using humour, and in fact known for being bright and sparkling and witty in their presentations. Now, most of that debate has turned from wit and humour into vitriol. What do you think has been the influence that has eliminated the witty politician from that sort of public discourse?
Geez, that's a hard question. You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, I tried to sit through four question times last week in Canberra, and it was utter just torture. It really was. And a couple of times I got up after 20 minutes and said to Dennis Shanahan or whoever it was I was sitting next to, I just can't take another moment of this, and just because it's just garbage. Robert Hughes joked about, well, I don't know if it was a joke actually, about satire having superseded reality, and the thing about, you know, people like Wayne Swan and plenty of people on the coalition front bench in Canberra, is that when they just do what they do, I mean, that's funny enough. And that's not good, you know, because, I mean, you know, I think Christopher Pine's one of the funniest people in Canberra. I mean, he is just absolutely hilarious. And if you had to have 10 people around the table at your last dinner party, he'd certainly be one of them. Peter Costello, you know, obviously Paul Keating. But, yeah, look, there's just some really average communicators in politics these days. And I think it's, you know, I spoke about it during this in the speech. I think the debasement of the lexicon is got a lot to do with it. I mean, just moving forward and, you know, cut to the bone and fiscal fear-mongering and these grabs that are just relentless. And they'll say it 100 times during one question time without any thought to a person who may be listening for 2 minutes instead of for that two-second grab on the news. And look, I know politicians have a job to do and they've got to sell their case, and but, you know, and I know it's easy, everyone has been doing it for a long, long time, you know, oh, woe betitis, you know, everything's being dumbed down. But it is one of the real losses in public life, because there isn't a lot of great oratory. But I live in hope.
Joe, just following on what you had to say there, well, where does that come from then? That overuse of language, that repetitiveness that you talk about in question time? Because I wonder if it comes from the fact of exactly where you've been, if you like, as an advisor. And is it because the advisors to our politicians, I've got to say, I look at many of them on a day-to-day basis and deal with them on a day-to-day basis, and I'm not sure on the advice that some of our politicians are getting about how they conduct themselves in news conferences and the language they use and that repetitiveness in question time and hammering a particular angle, so that if you do have to sit through an entire question time like you did and like I do on a weekly basis, then it becomes excruciating.
That's true. Well, I can certainly guarantee you that when I worked for Joe Hockey, we did not say work choices 60 times in a minute, that's for sure. Yeah, look, politics is a really intense game, and, you know, working, you know, from 6 in the morning or earlier till 10 o'clock at night, 7 days a week for 3 years is, you know, pretty tough on you, and also being paid pretty crap money to do it. So if, you know, the next Galileo doesn't come out of, you know, the pool of coalition or Labour advisors, that's not going to be a great surprise. It's a great training ground, but it's certainly, I think, something that for young people to learn how government works and learn how the media works and all those kind of things. But that's not to say that politicians can blame the fact that they can blame advisers. I mean, you know, only, what, 25 years ago, when Gerard was working in Old Parliament House, MPs shared offices with each other, let alone staff. I mean, that's just... And Barry worked there as well. You know, now ministers have 25 staff. So there are plenty of people around. There's plenty of people lifting weights. So I don't know that that's the explanation. But look, I think it's the professionalisation of messaging, you know, focus groups and all of those kind of things. And
there's a question down there somewhere. Yeah. Whoever's got the microphone? Oh, okay, here. And then we'll go down there. Yeah. Robert.
Do you ever feel a tension between the people who read you and the people who pay you?
Yep. Particularly if you're writing about the people that pay you, that's always, you know, a fairly hairy proposition. but I've been really impressed with how Fairfax, while I've been there, has handled that particular one. But generally, look, this is the only newspaper I've ever worked for on staff, so I can't talk about others, but the management and the editorial management and the commercial management understand that, you know, eyeballs mean revenue in our case. And it's pretty accepted that pushing the boundaries sells papers and gets people talking. So that's a pretty minimal problem.
There's a question there.
I vaguely remember when you were faking it at a corporate job, you started writing a book. Whatever happened to that book?
I can't. Who let her in?
She's on your list.
Yes, I was writing a novel. That was after I went to the 2008 Sydney Institute dinner and I was clicked at for a red wine. I spun into such an existential crisis of self, I decided I should be a novelist. So... That was never finished, unfortunately, but maybe one day.
Is that a threat or is that? So, well, Ian, I think you've had a go. So, who have I missed? Okay, well, since we're so respectful of News Limited here, we'll give Ian a final go, and then we'll go final question to Barry O'Farrell. Yeah, Ian, you. It's got to be brief.
Sure. Joe, in a biography that was written a few years ago about yourself, it sounds like you wrote it, you said there's one particular thing that you did not want to disclose about your personal life. So I'm just wondering, do you feel that you would be quite happy to be subject to the same intensity of intervention in terms of personal scrutiny about your private life as you subject to some other people?
Absolutely not. I'd hate to be subjected to the same scrutiny. I hate it all the time. But in terms of that biography, I think you find that was tongue-in-cheek.
So we got a final question from Barry O'Farrell.
Joe, terrific talk tonight, and as one of those imperfect public figures, can I say, you know, more power to your arm, and it's great to hear at least two or three journalists in the room talking about correcting Collins. I look forward to one day that happening. But can I seriously congratulate you on your terrifying fearlessness? But my serious question is, do you have any friends left?
Well, my mum's here, and that's the main thing. I do think so, and that's one of the great comforts when times are tough, because it is a tough, emotionally tolling, heavy toll this job it has, and I know who my real friends are, and they really do get me through, and I'm very, very lucky to. I sometimes shake my head at how lucky I am to have some of the friends I do. But so, yes, I do.
I'll sleep easy.
Well, look, it's been an important night. It's been a lot of fun as well, and we've had a few arguments, and that's what we're all about at the Sydney Institute. So to have a real live and alive gossip columnist along talking about silliness, prurience and sedition has been... a lot of fun, and no doubt we'll renew it in the future, but for tonight, congratulations and well done. I call on Joe Gersh to give a vote of thanks.
Thank you. Sorry, Joe. No, don't worry.
Thanks,
Joe,
for the prompt.
I'm here to answer Barry O'Farrell's question. I'm one of Joe's friends. Premier, Mrs. Aston, can I say that we've just had Joe as a weekend guest with us down on the peninsula this past weekend, and tonight's performance, to the contrary, he's actually been very well brought up. Joe, of course, has become the star of both stage and screen. He now appears every Sunday morning on Channel 9. So that if you haven't had enough all week, you can actually see him in person on Channel 9. Listening to his performance tonight and comparing it to what we see on the television, we understand that if I were a journalist and I died, I would like to come back as Joe Aston. Because if you look at, you know, his calendar just for this year, he's been to the Grand Prix, he's been to the tennis, he's been to the Milan Furniture Fair, he's been wherever the great and the good gather with a glass of wine, or even the budget lock-up, as he told us on Channel 9, where you can't get a glass of wine. Wherever people gather, it's his job to enliven the Financial Review, which just quietly, as somebody who reads it every day, because I have to, is not the world's most interesting newspaper. I'll be very brief, but it was Ayn Rand, whose name you're allowed to mention at least at the Sydney Institute, who said, who put the question to her lead character, Howard Rourke, which is, what do you think of me? And he came back with the ultimate insult, which is, but I don't think of you. And Joe's column actually straddles the need to be spoken about and the need not to be spoken about, I think, very, very ceremoniously. But can I, in conclusion, say, as the person who invited Joe to join the Sydney Institute when he was still a student at UTS, we've known each other that long and I haven't aged a day since, how wonderful it is to have somebody who's followed the fortunes of the Sydney Institute has actually, in his presentation, not only dealt with the subject, but given some great hope to those who are original thinkers, who get the political system, and, you know, is one of a generation of people who I hope will provide the thought leadership and cultural leadership in the future. I hope to see him back here again, and thank you, Joe, as well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.